He was fired. And he revealed.
Hi, everybody. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air.
I got to check that out.
This is what I call.
James Comey agreed today that absolutely happened.
I want to say it. When you can do what you want to do and go where you want to go and leave where you want to be and love who you want to love.
That's low.
What you wanna do? Well, that's freedom. Ah, yeah, freedom. Yes, sir. When you can learn what you wanna learn and read what you wanna read and write what you wanna write.
This is Chicago's finest internet radio show, making a world a better place, one show at a time. The George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. Take it away, Dad.
All right, welcome to the George Wilder Jr. Show. We might be having some internet issues. Oh, but still, we're going to go on with the show. Today is Thursday. Comey testified on Capitol Hill today, and it was pretty compelling. I mean, obviously, the White House is playing it down, obviously. What else is new with the White House? They're playing it down because they're trying to say Comey broke the law by leaking this memo to the leaking his, I think his writings of what went on in the, at that meeting on January to the press. I don't buy that. He's trying to say that Trump's lawyers trying to say that Trump's been vindicated and that he won. Don't believe that. He did not win because of this investigation is ongoing. But there's no doubt about it. This testimony from James Comey was damaging to Trump. You know, it was totally damaging. You know, even if they try to play it off or lie about it or spin it away, it's not going to happen. It was damaging to Trump. You know, so it was damaging. And I agree. Comey's testimony shows. See if I can't get this together. Apparently not. Apparently not. But anyway, Comey's testimony shows it's not the crime that could hurt Trump. It's the cover up. There's no doubt about it. Trump covered this up. He tried to hide it. And I do think Comey, there were some things he couldn't say. There were some important questions that he was being asked that he couldn't say because he couldn't divulge any information because there is an active investigation going on into Trump. And you have to realize Comey said at the time Trump was not a part of any investigation. He told them three times at the time he did. But right now he could be a part. Right now, today, currently, there's a possibility that he could be a part of a Russian investigation. But this is not in the hands of Comey anymore. I think basically watching the millions and zillions of people watch the this Comey testify on Capitol Hill today. And I think Comey is a reputable. I think he's a trustworthy guy. I think he chose his words carefully. And he did Trump no favors. Believe me. The guy said Trump tried to defame him, which Trump did. There's no doubt about that. But Trump and his lawyers are looking at Comey saying that three times that Trump was not a part of any investigation going on that time. This is what they are looking at. And some of them are calling and saying Trump did not lie. Trump is the biggest liar that ever came up out of the sewer. And Comey blows the lid off this. I don't see how the Trump administration can take this as a win. This is not a win. This is damaging. Okay. It's impeachable, you know, in some circles it's impeachable. And obviously Paul Ryan and the rest of the House of Representatives don't think it comes to an impeachable defense, but the American people think it does. When it comes to President Donald Trump, Russian interference in the election, the issue is the cover-up, not the crime. This is what they're saying. And I do think this is damaging to Trump. You know, I mean, it really is. And I'll say this again. I thought Comey came off as trustworthy, and he answered the questions that he could answer. The day before, you had four public officials in front of the Intel committee, and these guys didn't answer a damn thing. It was four of them. I'm not going to call their names because I think they're pathetic. They got there in front of the American people and would not answer any questions, the four of them, as if they were, I don't know, godsend or something. They did not answer nothing. I mean, when people don't answer questions, direct questions, you always think the obvious. Yeah, it must have happened because they're not directly answering it. So it must have happened. Okay, when it comes to President Donald Trump and Russian interference in the election, the issue is the cover-up, not the crime. That's the takeaway from former FBI James Comey dramatic testimony before Congress on today, this Thursday. The issue is not the crime, but the cover-up. And actually, in my circles, a cover-up is a crime. Trump was not under criminal investigation himself when Comey was fired last month. He was not under criminal edge. So that's the reason why Comey said that he was not three times. He was not under criminal investigation. You know, Comey told the Senate Intelligence Committee what could put the president in hot water with special counsel Robert Mueller. Now are his alleged attempts to lean on Comey to end the FBI investigation. Yeah, his efforts to lean on him. Trump leans on everybody. He wants loyalty as if he's some sort of damn king. He's some emperor. You know, he's a dictator wannabe, but he's learning that this is not the way to go in America. You are nobody's dictator. And whether he likes it or not, he's the president of each and every American citizen, whether he likes it or not, whether he wants to be or not, or whether he thinks he can represent the entire country. You know, so did you see the did you see McCain, Senator John McCain? I mean, this guy, and it's all over Twitter and Facebook and other social media that I mean, I watched it this morning. I watched the testimony. But when John McCain, when they came to John McCain, it was pathetic. This guy looked like he didn't know what he was talking about. He looked as if he didn't know where he was. He was talking more about Clinton, the Clintons, the emails, something that's not relevant to what's going on. I heard him distinctly, kept saying President Comey. And I'm saying, wow. And when they realized his time was up, He bucked his eyes and said, "What? Oh, okay." You know, I mean, it's time for McCain to retire. It's time for this guy to just live out his last days in the green pastures of the United States. He looks like he's about 80 to 85 years old. I'm not saying that the elderly cannot function at that age, but I'm just saying John McCain can't. I mean, he embarrassed himself. He only embarrassed himself. He did not embarrass the committee or James Comey. And I'm pretty sure Twitter and Facebook and his colleagues and friends and whoever, they're talking about this now. He was awful. He was awful. It's time for him to hand in the, it's time for the guy to give it up, you know. But basically, I watched the hearings. I had my popcorn just like everybody else. Millions of people around the country and around the world watched this thing. And after all of it was over, I mean, Trump's lawyers came storming out to the microphones and saying that they have been vindicated. It was a win for Donald Trump, and Comey may have broken the law and or did break the law. And, you know, I mean, you can't really believe anything that comes out of the White House. Well, I mean, you sat there and you listened for yourself and you heard Comey say that whether Trump engaged in obstruction of justice is a focus of Mueller's investigation, which is great. A lot of the things that they asked him, they were good questions, but he couldn't answer them because, you know, the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, you know, he's into several investigations into the Trump administration, and he didn't want to compromise any of that, which is understandable. And my understanding, a lot of Trump lawyers wish he would keep his mouth shut and wish he would stop tweeting, because tweeting is criminalizing him. I mean, every time he tweets something, it's going to be used against him, you know, his defense weaker. So it was a show this morning. I mean, I wasn't bored with it. I thought Comey was, I thought he was forward. I thought he was telling the truth of whatever he could say. I didn't think he was actually trying to throw Trump under the bus. I didn't think he was actually trying to get Trump impeached. I think the guy was just telling the truth. But yet, Trump and his lawyers and his minions, you know, are calling him a dirty, rotten liar, you know? And what else would you expect out of this administration? What else would you expect from Donald Trump? I mean, you know, it is what it is with Donald Trump. Okay, we are my guest today is Kevin Judge on dealing with a bad boss. That's going to be interesting. Hopefully, we will have him on the show, and we'll be right back. We're going to do a musical break. Yeah, it says here, by firing Comey, Trump created a powerful enemy, no longer entirely constrained by the traditions of the FBI or the desire to keep his job. I agree. I think Trump has created a lot of enemies among the intel community, the FBI, CIA, whatever you want to call it. I mean, he has created a lot of enemies within these agencies himself, compounding their era. Trump administration and the president himself angered Comey with what Comey called their shifting explanations for his firing that they left him with confused. They left him with being confused and concerned. I mean, this is all true, because if you've been studying Trump or since he's been president of the United States, and even before that, you know that all of this stuff is accurate, because Trump seems like the type of guy who would confuse you to the end where you are very, very concerned about, you know, what's going on. The White House initial story that Comey was fired because of his handling of the investigation into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's emails didn't make much sense. This is him talking to me for a whole bunch of reasons, Comey said today at the hearing. You know, so this is not over. If the Trump administration thinks that this is not over, this is not, why it's not over, because there is still a continuing investigation going on by former FBI Director Robert Mueller, who is the special counsel. I mean, special counsel means that he's not adhering to any party, Democrat or Republican. He's not adhering to any party. He's going to come out with a thorough, unbiased, hopefully results, you know, into this. And whether, you know, that's because Trump is a part of this one. He may not have been a part of the one that FBI Comey was, that investigation, but he is a part of this investigation. So, you know, and they are and they are clicking their heels right now saying that, well, we've been vindicated. We've won. You've won nothing. You've won nothing, you know. And I feel that the people who liked and admired Trump, they still do. And I feel that the people who can't stand him, they still can't stand him. I don't think anybody's gonna switch their vote because of this, or their thinking or their attitude toward the president of the United States, who all wish that, you know, a lot of people actually wished that Comey was more forthcoming and direct, and they wanted to see this guy. They wanted to see Comey bury Trump. They wanted to see him really bury Trump. And I think he did. I think he did, not in so many ways, but I think he did bury Trump. He came out and said that Trump tried to defame him and defame his agency. And he said that was straight up lies. And Trump is a liar. They're trying to say he didn't lie. Trump lies all the time as you look at him. The guy is a pathological liar. That means he cannot help but to lie. And he will lie again and again and again. And he will force the people around him to go out around the media circuit and lie for him some more. Trump makes himself look bad. He'll look around people in his circle. And he'll fire people because he made himself look bad. They had nothing to do with it. They're trying to defend him. But if they let him go out there and make a fool out of himself, he's going to look around and see who he can fire, who's going to be the scapegoat. That's my thinking. But the bottom line is, folks, we got an awful president. I mean, he is. When I, you know, first started talking about Trump on this show, I was telling people I didn't vote for him. You know, I didn't vote for him. I wouldn't have done that in a million years. But I was saying things like, give the guy a chance, you know, especially after the inauguration. I was saying, give him a chance. Who knows what he's going to, you know, he may wind up being something, you know, significant. Give him a chance. But then after 2 or 3 weeks or months or, you know, I'm saying, wow, we got to get rid of this guy. You know, even some of his supporters who voted for him were saying the same thing. You know, he goes overseas, he embarrasses us, he lies through his teeth, he sends these people out around the media, they lie, twist, and some of them, like Kellyanne Conway, they are just ridiculous, and they think we're going to fall for it. But you know what, now I believe that some of the people who are going to be going out speaking for Trump, they got new ammunition. They're going to get on these talk shows and they're going to, well, he was vindicated. He didn't do this. He didn't do that. And they're going to excoriate James Comey, you know. And I think the moderators, the hosts of these shows are going to realize that. They know it already. They know that Kellyanne Conway, Sean Spicer, and a lot of other Trump surrogates, they're going to go around the television shows, the radio, and all this kind of thing, and they're going to be touting, saying positive things about something that's still going on, an investigation. It's not over, but they're going to act as, oh, this is over, it's gone. President Trump didn't do anything. He didn't lie. He's been vindicated. No, he has not. There is still an ongoing investigation into his and the people around him into Russia meddling in the 2016 election. That's one of the things that James Comey did say. He did say that there was no doubt that Russia meddled in the 2016 election that gave Trump the White House. There was no doubt about that. If you think about campaign trail, if you think about that, in one of those rallies Trump was giving, he looked dead into the crank. This is video. It's out there. Check it out. He looked right into the camera and he said, "Russia, if you're listening," he virtually told them to attack Hillary's emails. He virtually told them to do that. And voila, they did it. Russia, if you're listening, and he promised something from the press also. So I never forgot that. You know, that video, that rally of what he's told Russia to do right on national television, to hack Hillary's emails. And they did it. And now people in the Trump administration are acting as if that video doesn't exist. And Paul Ryan is now currently going around saying that Trump is new at this. He's never been in government before. He doesn't know how to act. He doesn't know what's what, as if that's an excuse. Trump is a pussy grabber. He admits it. He's had several bankruptcies. He's been sued over 50. I mean, he's been sued a lot. And he's currently being sued now as I speak. Trump was awful before he became president, and he's awful now. Who knows? Maybe in a year or two or 6 months, he may learn a little bit more about who he is and the job he has to do. And maybe he will become a little better at dealing with people. He has to realize that he's the president of the United States. That means he's the president of all people here, all the citizens here. Whether he likes it, I heard him say once that he was president of Pittsburgh, not Paris. He's president of the United States. But I do think Trump is more president to people who support him. If you don't support him, he'll just say F off. You know, so we're going to have to see where this goes, you know, and I have to commend Comey because I think he gave a great, great, great testimony. You know, some of the things he said bury Trump. But hey, wow, you can't tell that to his administration. The people, they don't think so. But I think so, and a lot of other people think so. It buried him. Is it a crime? It's more of a cover-up than a crime. I agree with the article. It's more of a cover-up than a crime. But still in all, he is under serious investigations.
Run. I don't know. We were going to have a little more fun tonight about this crazy name calling, but my God, this is much more important than the name calling, calling people, you know, dead eyes, what's his name, or whatever latest little moniker he throws at somebody. Mueller's not going to be best with it. Mueller's now getting this information as we're getting it. Mm-hmm. This is a lot of stuff indicating obstruction of justice. All that Nixon did, although it was criminal and cost him his office, was have the CIA say, we're into this case, FBI, get out of it. This is now 4 points of contact with the president saying, set me loose, free me.
Yeah, it's true. And I think we'd make a mistake, by the way, listening to the discussion you just had. I think we'd all make a mistake if we frame this in terms of a narrow issue of collusion between the Trump campaign, maybe even Donald Trump himself, and the Russians over the hacking. That sort of collusion was not necessary for the Russians to do what they did, but it's interesting to know that the FBI investigation seems to be broadening in scope. They're looking at financial crimes now, we're hearing. These investigations tend to...
All righty. Welcome back to the George Wilder Jr. Show. I'm going to say this. They say this again. It was very interesting watching this all play out in my living room this morning. It was very interesting. All right. You're on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Go right ahead.
Hello. This is Kevin Judge calling from Ottawa, Canada, the author of How to Fix a Bad Boss.
Yeah, man, I am so glad you showed up on the show. Thanks for coming. Thanks for doing it. And just give us a little bit more of your bio and why did you write this book?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, in my career, I've worked with 21 years for different corporations, only a couple of corporations. But in those 21 years, I had 27 bosses. And I tell you,
wow!
Out of those bosses, yeah, that's a lot of bosses, and it wasn't me, really. It was a lot of organizational shift happening there. But out of those bosses, so many of them were okay bosses, which is a really great thing. And a few of them were awesome. They were the best bosses you could ever want. But unfortunately, there was also a few that were so horrible, it was life-changing. And not only life-changing for me, but I saw how their behavior impacted other employees and the corporation itself, the damage that it was creating for the company and the people. And I thought, gee, there's got to be a way to manage this and to help people be successful. And so that's why I decided to write this book.
You know, I think a lot of people, a lot of Americans can probably say the same thing, that every now and then we would, you know, find employment and we will run across a bad boss. You would hear some of them say that they're all over the place. I mean, I myself had experienced with bad bosses, bad supervisors, bad managers, you know, and just being awful in the workplace. And I remember this movie called Horrible Bosses. I don't know how fictional, I don't know how they fictionalized it, but it was, it's nonfiction. It happens. And you know what? It's still happening. You still got bad bosses out here in some of these workplaces.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? That's a pretty funny movie, fairly recent. One of my favorite movies related to the workplace is called Office Space. I don't know if you've seen it or not. But some prime examples in there of bad bosses as well, and just the impact they have on people. So it is amazing how much damage that it can create, not only on people's own confidence and their emotional well-being, it can have an impact on people's physical well-being as well. I recall there was one bad boss I was working for, and I actually was driving. I had about a two-hour drive in front of me, and I was driving, and I was doing a lot of thinking about the situation. And I actually envisioned myself having a heart attack. And I thought,
wow,
you know what? This has got to stop. Now, I didn't have a heart attack, but I thought, gee, I'm so stressed out. I've gained so much weight.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, sometimes these bosses can, sometimes I think they intentionally stress you out, you know, and they want you to take them home. You want take that? I don't know. They want you to take home with you their behavior in some ways.
Yeah. So it will stretch terms, you out. Oh, absolutely. And you'll hear terms like a boss, when you ask them, you know, why are you behaving the way you're behaving, or why did you say that or do that to your team? And they say, well, I wanted to light a fire under them to get them to perform better. And unfortunately, all the fire does under somebody is burn them. So
yeah, true.
Right. But, you know, I have to let you know that most bosses that are bad, they're actually good people. And I know that's probably hard for a lot of people to consider, but they're actually good people, but they're just bad bosses. And a lot of the time, they're doing what they think is the right thing to do for the well-being of the company or for their job, and they don't know any other way. And their behavior has been tolerated or even rewarded by the organization
yeah.
in the past.
Yeah.
So they continue to do it.
But isn't there something abuse of power, overstepping your bounds? Some of these guys and girls who are supervisors and managers, I mean, they like it. I mean, it gives them a feeling of power when they're doing bad things to their employees.
Well, for some people, absolutely. And we could even go so far as to say, like, people ask me, can every bad boss be helped? And my answer is, most likely the bad boss situation that you're facing can be resolved. But there's about 1% of the population that are psychopaths, and I can't help them. But for everybody else, they might get a bit of an adrenaline rush when they're doing things.
Yeah.
But most often it's funny because most often their behavior is actually as a result of fear of failure, fear of being found out as being incompetent, fear of other people progressing further than them. So it really is a lot of the time based on fear.
So how do you actually deal with a bad boss? I mean, if you're getting a job and you want to keep your job, so how do you actually deal with a bad boss?
So it's a great question, and there's two perspectives from it, and so I'll talk a little bit about both. But one is from the corporate perspective. So if I'm the head of HR or I'm a senior leader, and there's a boss or that works underneath me, who's getting a lot of complaints about his behavior or her behavior, then I, as that senior leader, need to deal with that, or I, as HR, human resources, need to deal with that. So the book goes into talking to the organization about what is it the organization can do to resolve this problem, and what happens if you don't. But I have not forgotten that the employees that are out there, they need some help too. And there's really a few choices. Well, there's really only two choices that you have to make first as somebody that's suffering from a bad boss. And it's a simple question. Do you want to stay? Yes or no? And while it's a simple question, it's not an easy one to answer because there's so many thoughts. Are you being held back because you're almost ready to retire? You don't want to give up your pension, or there's a really tight labor market and it's really hard to find other jobs. You want to stay because whatever the reason is. But then I ask people to think, well, if the problem went away, would you still want to work for the company, or has it been so bad for so long that you just don't want to work there anymore, right?
Yeah. So what is the title of your book?
The title of my book is called How to Fix a Bad Boss, 8 ways to end the trail of distress in the workplace and cultivate a winning manager-employee relationship.
So do you have your book with you?
It's actually an upcoming book. It's going to be coming out in the next few months, but I do have a bit of a draft in front of me.
Okay. Can you give us a little bit of that?
Sure. So what I'll do is I'll read you a short piece. I actually want to, at the beginning, I introduce people to two characters. Now, the book is not fictional, but I do go into two characters to give people a bit of a flavor of what a bad boss is. Here's one bad boss I'd like to introduce you to. Her name is Janet.
Okay.
Janet was a very nice person. She had a family, went to church regularly, and even helped her father on his farm. She was a director and was recognized as a superstar to senior leaders in the company. She volunteered for projects that nobody else wanted, and she always delivered, no matter how hard the projects were. Those results earned her superstar status, and that made Janet quite influential in the organization. But behind closed doors, Janet was known as the wrecking ball. She destroyed people's self-confidence and would make life miserable for anyone that got in her way. She'd ask them for information and rarely give any in return. She'd micromanage your micro expressions on your face. Even though her team was filled with intelligent and experienced people, she never trusted them to determine the best way to get things done. She threatened her employees with canceled vacation and losing their jobs if they didn't meet her unrealistic expectations. She overreacted and yelled at employees when mistakes were made or if they weren't identified. And oh my gosh, if a senior leader ever gave constructive feedback on work that her team did, there was hell to pay. In short, Janet dominated through aggression and intimidation. Now, the last little bit here. Fed up with Janet and a lack of action by the company, in just over a year, two managers, a replacement manager, a senior analyst, and three staff quit. The people that stuck around disengaged more and more every day, and productivity diminished. Cynicism spread like a virus, and their trust in the organization was lost. They held on hoping that something would change, and eventually it did. Janet was promoted. I'll leave it at that.
Do you think there are actual people out here in the workplace like Janet?
I do. There's
me
lots
too.
Of people like Janet. Absolutely. And the challenge is many of them don't know that that's the way they are or the way they're being perceived. They don't know the damage they're causing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The employee that's suffering does, and the most senior leaders in human resource departments do because they're getting the complaints, but the offending manager is clueless. And so they need help. They need.
Yeah. So another thing I wanted to ask about Janet. Do you think she actually costs the company money?
Guaranteed she does. So in the example that I gave you, all of those employees that leave, every time somebody leaves, there's a productivity dip, and it costs money to hire new people. And I have a business case that I create to help organizations figure out what the cost is, and it's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars over a 6 month to 1 year period of damage that somebody like a Janet creates. Isn't that amazing?
So somebody like a it is. So somebody like a Janet is actually a liability to the company.
Absolutely a liability.
Wow.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's a liability that the organization has to do something with. And the challenge there is many organizations, they're afraid to take action. They're afraid to give feedback. Usually somebody like a Janet, they're a superstar. They get stuff done, or they own shares of the company, or they they're friends with the CEO or whatever it is, there's usually some reason that makes them seem untouchable. And what they really need is to get that feedback and to get some help so that they can actually be successful. They can be more successful than they already are. And so it's about getting the organization to make a decision to act and not ignoring it. Because ignoring it is a decision to do nothing. And doing nothing is what's degrading the employee experience and making the good people leave. And you know, when the good people leave, do you know who stays when the good people leave?
Who?
The people that aren't very good employees, they stay.
I was going to say that, but I...
Yes, your lowest performers stay.
I was going to say that, but I was going to let you say it because you're the expert. Author Kevin Judge on the George Wilder Jr. Show. This is a great subject, man, because I, like I've told you before, I have worked for a few bad bosses and I've worked for some good ones. And I've worked for one guy. He was just as nasty as he can be. I mean, he was nasty. It didn't care.
Yeah.
It didn't matter how good you were at your job, you know, or how much you saved the company money and brought in the clientele. I mean, this guy was just nasty. And and the thing about it, management, you know, they like what he was doing, because a lot of the employees went to complain to management about this guy. And as you've alluded to or said earlier, they gave this guy a promotion. He was just stepping on people, you know? All right, Kevin Judge on the George. Okay, we're running out of time. Kevin Judge on the George Wilder Jr. Show. When you get that book done, man, come back on the show and we're going to talk about this again, because this is something that's affecting a lot of people. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people want to know about how to deal with a bad boss. So tell everybody where they can get in touch with you. Tell everybody where they can get in touch with you, how they can learn more about this, because it is a phenomenal out here in the workplace. Bad bosses.
Sure thing, George. You know what? What I'd love to do is offer everybody a free downloadable copy of the book when it's ready. If they want to have a hard copy book, it will be published and printed in hard copy as well. But there's tons of resources that are available for people today. If you go to fixabadboss.com, that's fixabadboss.com. There's loads of resources on there, and you can sign up to get notified when that book is coming out later this year.
You know what? I'm going to take this specific show. I'm going to share it. I'm going to put it everywhere where I know people, where people can gravitate to this particular show, who are actually in the workplace and may or may not have a bad boss. You never know. You may quit your job. You may have a great boss, and then you quit your job and you find out the job that your new job is there's a bad boss or two there. So I do think that this is great. I think because we've all had bad bosses, you know. So, and you offering to write this book, you're offering a lot of your own experience with bad bosses.
Yes, that's well. I've also interviewed a number of people, both that have experienced it and also from the human resources side of things, just so that it's not all my story. It's a whole bunch of people and what they've faced.
All right, Kevin Judge on the George Wilder Jr. Show. Thanks for being on the show, and let me know when you get that book done.
Thanks very much, George. It's been a pleasure. Good luck to you.
Bye-bye. You too. All right, Kevin Judge on the George Wilder Jr. Show. We will be right back, folks, when doves cry.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families. The last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway, and he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school, and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me, that I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence and see how she reacts. And here's where those guns come in. As soon as we moved to New England, you know, that place where Connor was supposed to feel so safe, he bought 3 guns. He kept one in the glove compartment of our car. He kept one under the pillows on our bed. And the third one he kept in his pocket at all times. And he said that he needed those guns because of the trauma he'd experienced as a young boy. He needed them to feel protected. But those guns were really a message for me. And even though he hadn't raised a hand to me, my life was already in grave danger every minute of every day. Connor first physically attacked me 5 days before our wedding. It was 7 a.m. I still had on my nightgown. I was working on my computer trying to finish a freelance writing assignment, and I got frustrated. And Connor used my anger as an excuse to put both of his hands around my neck and to squeeze so tightly that I could not breathe or scream. And he used the chokehold to hit my head repeatedly against the wall. 5 days later, the 10 bruises on my neck had just faded, and I put on my mother's wedding dress, and I married him. Despite what had happened, I was sure we were going to live happily ever after, because I loved him, and he loved me so much. And he was very, very sorry. He had just been really stressed out by the wedding and by becoming a family with me. It was an isolated incident, and he was never going to hurt me again. It happened twice more on the honeymoon. The first time, I was driving to find a secret beach, and I got lost. And he punched me in the side of my head so hard that the other side of my head repeatedly hit the driver's side window. And then a few days later, driving home from our honeymoon, he got frustrated by traffic, and he threw a cold Big Mac in my face. Connor proceeded to beat me once or twice a week for the next 2.5 years of our marriage. I was mistaken in thinking that I was unique and alone in this situation. 1 in 3 American women experiences domestic violence or stalking at some point in her life. And the CDC reports that 15 million children are abused every year. 15 million. So actually, I was in very good company. Back to my question. Why did I stay? The answer is easy. I didn't know he was abusing me. Even though he held those loaded guns to my head, pushed me downstairs, threatened to kill our dog, pulled the key out of the car ignition as I drove down the highway, poured coffee grinds on my head as I dressed for a job interview, I never once thought of myself as a battered wife. Instead, I was a very strong woman in love with a deeply troubled man, and I was the only person on earth who could help Connor face his demons. The other question everybody asks is, why doesn't she just leave? Why didn't I walk out? I could have left any time. To me, this is the saddest and most painful question that people ask, because we victims know something you usually don't. It's incredibly dangerous to leave an abuser, because the final step in the domestic violence pattern is kill her. Over 70% of domestic violence murders happen after the victim has ended the relationship, after she's gotten out, because then the abuser has nothing left to lose. Other outcomes include long-term stalking, even after the abuser remarries, denial of financial resources, and manipulation of the family court system to terrify the victim and her children, who are regularly forced by family court judges to spend unsupervised time with the man who beat their mother. And still we ask, why doesn't she just leave? I was able to leave because of one final sadistic beating that broke through my denial. I realized that the man who I loved so much was going to kill me if I let him. So I broke the silence. I told everyone. The police, my neighbors, my friends and family, total strangers. And I'm here today because you all helped me. We tend to stereotype victims as grisly headlines, self-destructive women, damaged goods. The question, why does she stay, is code for some people for it's her fault for staying. as if victims intentionally choose to fall in love with men intent upon destroying us. But since publishing Crazy Love, I have heard hundreds of stories from men and women who also got out, who learned an invaluable life lesson from what happened, and who rebuilt lives, joyous, happy lives, as employees, wives, and mothers, lives completely free of violence. Like me, because it turns out that I'm actually a very typical domestic violence victim and a typical domestic violence survivor. I remarried a kind and gentle man. We have those three kids. I have that black lab, and I have that minivan. What I will never have again, ever, is a loaded gun held to my head by someone who says that he loves me. Now, right now, maybe you're thinking, wow, this is fascinating. Or, wow, how stupid was she? But this whole time, I've actually been talking about you. I promise you, there are several people listening to me right now who are currently being abused, or who were abused as children, or who are abusers themselves. Abuse could be affecting your daughter, your sister, your best friend right now. I was able to end my own crazy love story by breaking the silence. I'm still breaking the silence today. It's my way of helping other victims. And it's my final request of you. Talk about what you heard here. Abuse thrives only in silence. You have the power to end domestic violence simply by shining a spotlight on it. We victims need everyone. We need every one of you to understand the secrets of domestic violence. Show abuse the light of day by talking about it with your children, your coworkers, your friends and family. Recast survivors as wonderful, lovable people with full futures. Recognize the early signs of violence and conscientiously intervene, de-escalate it, show victims a safe way out. Together, we can make our beds, our dinner tables, and our families the safe and peaceful oases they should be. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, that's that was on domestic violence, and I had a guest on the show, I think a couple of days ago, Tori Talbert, and she's an advocate against domestic violence. So am I, and she was surprised to. It appears that she was surprised to see that I was an actual advocate against beating up on women. You know, I mean, what man in there? I guess you got a lot of men who don't agree with that. But, you know, it's a bad thing that's going on in America. Just like just got through discussing bad bosses. This happens. Not every boss in every workplace around America, around the world are bad bosses. You got some great bosses, some bosses that, you know, that the employees actually like, if not love. So there's some great bosses and there are some assholes. Believe me, there are some assholes in every aspect of life. You know, it doesn't have to be a bad boss. It could be a bad police officer, a bad doctor, a bad accountant, you know. A bad service representative, you know, because a lot of times we make calls to find out information on certain things. We get a representative answer the phone and they have attitudes and stuff. So some, not all. I mean, you have to deal with the right people, you know. And domestic violence is if I can get back on it, it's something that I've written about. I just like Kevin Judd, I've also fictionalized things on domestic violence to show how bad it can be and how we, everybody, it's not just a woman's problem. It's everybody's problem. It's everybody in society's problem. Because as I sit here and as I was sitting there, we were talking, Tori and I were talking, and she was saying the same thing as I was thinking, that domestic violence is going on right now at this very minute. Some woman is being plummeted. And we also talked about domestic violence isn't always the man beating up on the woman. Sometimes it's reversed. It's the woman beating up on the man. And that happens. But when you hear about domestic violence, automatically it shoots through your brain that some man is abusing his girlfriend or his wife or some other woman, you know. And more likely that is the case. But you can't deny that there is some women who are actually and I think for domestic violence to happen to a man, I think the woman who's doing the domestic violence, the battering of the man, her husband, boyfriend, or whoever, does it because she feels that that guy is somehow weak. You know, he's a weak person, or he's weak at this, he's weak at that. And I think that gives them strength over somebody who's weak. Because there's a lot of men out here who will not raise their hand to a woman. And there's too many that will. Majority of the time when there is a man who will not raise his hand towards a woman, will not put his hand on a woman violently, that woman may think he's weak. He's weak. So he's not going to beat me, so I'm going to beat him. It could be any of that scenario playing out, you know. But I'm just throwing it out there. 347-857-1762, the George Wilder Jr. Show is now on the air. And I have been talking with the great Kevin Judd on Bad Bosses. And I think this is the reason why I'm still talking about it, usually I don't continue to talk about what I've talked about with a guest, but this is something that has affected me, has affected him, and I'm pretty sure has affected you or somebody that you might know. But don't get me wrong, there's a lot of great, great, great bosses in the world. And I've had them throughout at some points in my life. I've had good bosses and I can name them, and I've had awful bosses. I guess it's just a part of just going through life, especially if you're going from one job to the next. Then I've had bosses where, you know, you didn't give you actual credit for what you've done for the company. The bosses will take the credit. And I've had that scenario happen to me. But I've never written about it. I've never written about a bad boss. Maybe that's a story. Maybe that's a short novelette sometime coming in the future from George Wilder Jr., the writer. And it's just, we're trying to make the world a better place. That's all. Even with the bad bosses and the domestic violence that's constantly happening, things that are happening right now as I speak, as I do the show, as you listen, it's surreal. It is so surreal that, and I've had plenty of women on the show who have actually been victims of domestic violence. I don't think anybody can really actually talk about domestic violence unless they haven't experienced it. If you experience it, then you have a story to tell. And your story is probably wanting other women to know how to deal with an abusive situation, how to get out of an abusive situation, and never to go back to a abusive situation, you know. So, You know, just this morning I was out taking my not annual, but daily walk. And just this morning, I walked up on this guy. He was walking his dog. A lot of people around in this area walk their dog. I mean, dogs are all over the place. They're walking dogs. But this particular guy, his dog, I knew the breed of the dog. You know, it was a pit bull, but he was a nice, gentle little fellow. Okay. He wasn't a violent dog. He was gentle. I mean, as I walked by, the dog was, he had a leech on the dog. The dog was sitting in the grass as he had the leech on the dog. It was very nice. It was summery type weather. And like, because they still have the dogs out. The dogs out walking the dogs. Sometimes the dogs are walking the owners, okay? But I walked past him, and he kneed the dog in the mouth. He kneed the dog. He was basically jerking the dog, the chain on the dog, you know, choking the dog with the leech. And he did it several times as I was walking by, you know, and then he put his knee up to touched his knee to the dog's mouth. And I looked back at this, and he was still jerking the dog by the leech on the chain. And he was just standing there jerking the chain on the dog. And the dog was actually whimpering. He was crying. And so I guess my point is, people who are abusive, they are going to be abusive. They have to have something to abuse, whether it's a dog, it's a woman, it's a child, an older person, an elderly person. People just have to abuse something because there are innate abusers. And that's not right. That's a shame, but it happens. And so we just have to try to get abusers out of society, whether it's a dog or a woman or a cat or someone in a wheelchair, a nursing home. People are being abused, you know, for no reason at all, just because the person that's doing the abusing likes what they're doing. They get a kick out of what they're doing while they're kicking you. And that a lot of people are afraid. A lot of older Americans, a lot of elderly people are afraid of nursing homes. They are afraid of nursing homes. They don't want to leave their comfortability of their home to go to a nursing home that may be abusive. And I can't blame them. They want to stay in their own homes. And you got a lot of elderly people who are living with their kids, their adult children. Because the adult children, they don't even trust these nursing homes, and I don't blame them. You know, but in some cases where the adult children, they have their lives, they're working every day, they have their careers, and, you know, they don't have time. They don't have the time or the space to take care of mother or daddy, who are in their 70s and 80s and 90s. They don't have the space in their homes or the time to give. So they have to go about trying to choose a nursing home for their parent. And they don't really want to put their parent in a nursing home, but they just don't have the time. They have their own busy lives. The kids are off at college, and they have their own busy lives. So they choose a nursing home. They have no choice, when they choose a nursing home, they try to choose a good one that's not going to abuse their loved one. But you never know what's taking place during the nighttime hours when the nursing staff have to go in and check on your loved one, maybe change their clothing or diaper or whatever. And then you never know what's going on in there. So abusive and abusers, just like bad bosses in the workplace, are everywhere. Now, everybody is not going to abuse your loved one, but you never really know. You never really know who's going to abuse your loved one or who's going to be a bad boss. You just take your chances. But one of the things about having a bad boss is that you can, just like Kevin Judge said, you can just quit and find another job. Yeah, that's one of the remedies. And if you choose the wrong nursing home, you can always, you know, take your loved one out of that nursing home, sue it, sue the nursing home for abuse, and then, you know, find another nursing home or find someone to take care of your mom or dad while they're living in your house. It costs money, but if you can do it, you can do it. If you can't, then you have to find out what you can do. But abusive behavior is nothing new to America. It's nothing new to anybody. So anyway, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. It is a great day outside. It's summery. I didn't talk about the weather at the beginning of the show. I guess because of the breaking news of Jim Comey, the former FBI director, testifying to the Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill. And we didn't have time to get to the weather, but it's great. It's great. It's about 80 degrees or 75 to 80 degrees near the lake. Yeah, and it's beautiful. It's wonderful. We're going to go outside as soon as we're going to get out there and get some of that great air as soon as the show is over and in the books for next Monday. Yeah, in the books for next Monday. And it's been fun, folks. I enjoyed my guest. I hope you enjoyed the guest. And I hope you always tune into the George Wilder Jr. Show. I know it's a lot of people out there on the radio, they're podcasting, but this is the best thing that you can probably get on the internet, you know. So we've been doing it a long time, and it's fun. It's fun for everybody. And I'm going to keep doing it because I love it. I know there's some criticism of the show. I've heard it. But there's some criticism we just can't try to fix, but we can try to fix it. You know, it's criticism out here that, you know, I've had some guests come on the show and criticize the show, you know, in a subtle way. You know, they don't really come out and say, it's a rotten show. They don't really come out and say anything like that. I haven't heard anybody call it a rotten show, but criticism is there, and I don't mind criticism. You know, I mean, because I believe criticism makes you a better person. I do, especially when it's constructive, you know, instead of non-constructive. But anyway, it's Thursday, and it's been an interesting. It has been an interesting day. It's been a fun day. I've learned so much during on this day, watching the testimony of Jim Comey on Capitol Hill. I've learned a lot from that, even though I've, have my own opinions, have my own thoughts of what I see and what I hear. Nobody's going to change that. And that's how it goes. Okay, we're just about got how many more minutes into the show? A little over five minutes into the show. It's been fun. We've had some great guests throughout the week. We're going to have great guests next week. We're going to have great guests all through July. And we're going to get on that. We're going to book those. And we're going to have fun on the show. Folks, this is going to be fun. And I'm still getting people wanting to be on the show, and that's great. That's wonderful. It always makes me feel good whenever I, you know, get calls or emails or that people inbox me about being on the show. I think that's just wonderful, and it's beautiful. So we're going to be off as always. This show is on 4 days a week, 6 o'clock to 7:30 p.m. Chicago time, Central Standard Time. And we, it's a variety show, more so than a political show as it is characterized. It's a variety show. We talk about anything here. But since, you know, Donald Trump, the investigations, Jim Comey, Capitol Hill, all of this stuff is in the news. So I have to, I don't have to, but I do talk about it. I talk about, you know, getting out there to vote. You know, you want to change America. You don't like the way things are. It's in your hands to change it. Don't ever think that your vote will not count. Don't ever think that your vote is just nothing, because that's ludicrous. That is total. And I'm not talking about the actor or the rapper. It is ludicrous to think that your vote is not going to do anything. You know, I vote all the time, you know, every chance that I get, and every candidate that I vote for don't always win. But that doesn't stop me from voting. That doesn't stop me from voting, you know, because if one of my candidates that I voted for didn't win, at least two of them over here that I did win on the same day that I cast my ballot. So there's always an upside to it. So your vote does count. So we want you to get out there November 18th and change Congress. Change Congress. Throw a lot of those people out on their butts because they totally deserve it. All right, you've been listening to the George Wilder Jr. Show on Block Talk Radio. We're just about out of time. Here we go.
Bombs begin to fall. Heaven help the black man if he struggles one more day. Heaven help the white man if he turns back away. Heaven help the man who kicks the man who has a crawl.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great...
Help us all.